We are working on the edge of the nuclear apocalypse. And so we need to understand this. And we need to think what could be done about that, first of all, right? Then the solutions for Ukraine are, as I said, nowadays it's a part of a much bigger crisis, much bigger problems that are escalating with the U.S. hegemony decline, with economic environmental issues, buzzword, poly crisis. So the solutions for Ukraine are also part of the global solutions.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
Volodymyr Ischenko was born in Western Ukraine in 1982. He grew up in Kiev, taught sociology at Kiev universities, and was active in the Ukrainian New Left. He is now a researcher at Freie University in Berlin. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, Jacobin, and the New Left Review. Today, we're going to be discussing Ukraine and his book, Towards the Abyss, Ukraine from Maidan to War. Welcome to the Diet Soap podcast, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I sent you some sample questions in advance of this interview, and you noted that I spent a lot of time asking about the Ukrainian left, and you thought that was a mistake, as the Ukrainian left is an irrelevant segment of politics in Ukraine. As a leftist in the United States, at a time when it seemed to me that the left is irrelevant here, I'm hoping we might attempt to discover why the left is drifting into irrelevancy in many places, or if there is a common reason that can be understood internationally rather than just particular causes within each nation. But maybe I'm looking for a shortcut or attempting to be too much of a reductionist. What do you think?
Well, I actually do think that there are some of the globally relevant issues that also manifest in the weakness of the left. But the weakness is also kind of like a relative thing. I mean, when the United States have like Democratic Socialist Association, DSA, with quite many members, or at least it sounds quite many for a post-Soviet person. Well, the left in Ukraine have much more tragic history.
Yes. Well, I do recognize that, and perhaps I'm spoiled as a American citizen wanting more freedom and more relevancy than we currently have. But let's see, where should I start? I sent you these questions. You just said that the Ukrainian left has a much more tragic history than the American left. Would you say that the tragedy of the Ukrainian left developed out of the failure of the Soviet Union?
Well, many tragedies developed out of the failure of the Soviet Union, in fact, and that's only a part of that tragedy. Well, the dominant parties on Ukrainian left, which used to be quite relevant and used to control large portions of the Ukrainian parliament in the 1990s, had quite massive membership, also like the 1990s and then also in the 2000s. The Communist Party of Ukraine, the Socialist Party of Ukraine, some smaller parties, most of them were basically descendants of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And they had some of the problems that they also inherited from that party. They also had some of the, specifically post-Soviet developments that impacted the whole Ukrainian politics, but they also impacted the left parties in Ukraine, in particular, rise of what might be described as patronage politics, which is not even about any ideologies, any programs, any agendas, but basically this is pretty much informal patron-clientelistic politics where politics is basically to get something done for a very narrow group of people. So most of the political parties in Ukraine have been tightly connected to this informal patronage network, which started actually to develop in the late Soviet Union. But in the post-Soviet period, they had their heyday. And they also impacted the left segment of Ukrainian politics. So the Communist Party of Ukraine became kind of like a minor partner for the Party of Regions, which united most of the political capitalist elite in Ukraine. That was the party which supported Viktor Yanukovych, the president which was overthrown in the Euromaidan revolution. And it united some of the most the richest people in Ukraine, some of the richest oligarchs. At the peak moment, they were actually working as a party of the richest fraction of Ukrainian political capitalist class. And the Communist Party was, in many cases, they were supporting the Party of Regions. And they took the side of Yanukovych during the Euromaidan Revolution as well. There was a Socialist Party, which was actually an interesting party, it also like descended from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, but it kind of like was trying to move into more like into the direction of European social democracy. And for some period of time, it was actually quite to the left of the social democracy, and even containing some like Marxist clauses in the program. They were also trying to mobilize voters in other parts of Ukraine, so not in the eastern and southern parts where the communists were most popular, but the stronghold of the Socialist Party was in the central Ukraine. And specifically more in the rural areas. That party kind of, in a certain period of time, it became a kind of like a minor partner in the pro-Western bloc camp with the nationalists and neoliberals. Then they made a U-turn after the Orange Revolution in 2004. And then they became marginal and also kind of like predatory, destroyed by various political entrepreneurs. And the Communist Party was effectively banned or suspended quite soon after the Euromaidan Revolution and permanently banned after the full-scale invasion in a line of many other so-called pro-Russian parties, which is like a very broad label right now. The Socialist Party was banned, and the descendants of the Party of Regions were banned as well, and so on. So right now, there is effectively no single MP in Ukrainian parliament that could be characterized as left, even nominally. Okay. And they're not a single party.
Yeah. So reading through your book, you kind of divide your book between 2014 and 2022. And I'm interested in the section on 2014, at least I want to discuss it at the beginning here. What you just said, one of the things you just said, and correct me if I'm misremembering what you just said, but you said that the Democratic Socialists were often to the left of the Communist Party in Ukraine. Did I get that right?
No, not exactly. I meant the Socialist Party was trying to integrate into the Socialist International, the International of the Social Democratic Parties.
Right.
And yeah. To establish the connections with European social democracies, but it was not necessarily to the left of the Communist Party.
Okay. All right. So, what I was going to ask was whether what issues or what perspectives defined the difference between the social democratic Western oriented Socialist Party and the Communist Party at that time? Like what positions would you use to determine who's further to the left and further to the right in that moment in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, if those details get so interesting, then, for example, as I mentioned, the Socialist Party polled better in the more rural regions of the center of Ukraine. So the factor of class, the factor of region in Ukraine were important as distinguishing between these two parties. The Socialist Party was, for example, the Communist Party was quite explicitly in support of reintegration with Russia, and also strongly against NATO, strongly against the EU. The Socialist Party had, well, at least it tried to articulate a bit more like balanced position on those issues. So, for example, saying that it's not that important to integrate into the EU, but to build Europe within Ukraine. It's a way kind of like not being as anti-Western as the Communist Party, but also kind of like playing on the parts of the membership and the parts of the electorate which were not exactly pro-EU. But for example, as I said, during the Orange Revolution, the Socialist Party took the side of the pro-Western coalition, which protested against the stealing of the elections by Viktor Yanukovych in 2004. And the Socialist Party was also invited to the government, but they were not satisfied with the positions they've got there, and then they kind of like made a U-turn and joined a coalition with the Party of Regions and with the Communist Party. And one of the reasons was also the personal ambitions of the leader of the Socialist Party, and that perhaps was the biggest difference between them, which was a lot about the ambitions of the leaders and a little bit less about programmatic issues. As I said, the impact of this patronage, informal, clientelistic politics, which overrides the ideological differences, is perhaps underestimated in the public. But although the experts, the researchers who studied episodic politics, on the other hand, they do emphasize that these are kind of like patrimonial regimes. These are politics which is overridden by informal patronage networks, where the issue who is aligned with whom is much more important than being on the left, on the right, in the center, however you would nominally call your own party.
So it sounds like what defined people's politics or parties' politics was who they were courting for patronage or where they were seeking money. whether they were seeking.
Well, to quite a bigger extent, yes.
Yeah. But in the bio that I read, you are defined as being part of the new left, the Ukrainian new left. And it sounds to me like, from what we said so far, that new left has been pretty much completely smashed in Ukraine. But where would that new left have been, or to what extent was it an organized party-based formation in Ukraine, or what was that new left, the Ukrainian new left that you were part of?
Well, it has tried to, but it has never been capable to establish a party, not even close.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exactly it was smashed, but the problem is that it has been very marginal for practically all of the 30 years, all of the post-Soviet developments. So the biggest achievements of the new left were, for example, the student movement. And that was even before Euromaidan, when there was quite interesting student union, direct action, more like anarchist, which at some moment was capable to lead a quite significant student campaign. There were some achievements in the labor movement, but well, the labor movement itself was quite weak. And so the largest labor strike happened in 1993, more than 30 years ago. And that strike was also pretty much connected to the patronage interests of some of the Ukrainian elites. That was a minor strike in Donbass, and it's kind of like ironic to recall that they were striking for some of the, let's say, pro-Russian issues, autonomy for Donbass and other things. Some of the younger left were also kind of participating in those strikes. There were also smaller strikes, but more like on the local level, where the new left activists were trying to have some influence. The problem was that actually there was no even strong organization of the new left to influence the broader social groups, either workers or students. So the issue with the student movement was that the anarchists and other radical left in the direct action, they tried but have not been able to establish kind of like an ideological influence over the larger student movement. So it's basically it's kind of like disintegrated later. And so we are speaking at the big development, up to 1,000 activists across the whole country. The active participants of anything connected to the new left. Well, there was some probably a bit bigger passive audience. Well, the audience of the websites, participants of some events, we were speaking about the self-identified leftists connected to that milieu, actually splintered among the very different organizations. That's not a big one. And then after Euromaidan, a part of that new left, they supported Donbass separatists, and basically they excluded themselves from Ukrainian politics. They were expecting repression, and there was some repression. Yeah. And after supporting the pro-Russian separatists in Donbass, they didn't gain anything politically there. Although for a very short period of time, they played some significant role in anti-Maidan mobilizations in Kharkov and in Odessa, quite big cities in Ukraine. But those mobilizations were quickly repressed and disintegrated as a threat to post-Maidan government, and perceived also as a threat to Ukraine in general. The other part of the new left, many of them, they supported the Euromaidan revolution, but they were just too small, too disintegrated, too fragmented to have any significant impact on how those protests developed. After the Euromaidan, the milieu squeezed, narrowed. At the start of the invasion, there was some activization of like pro-Ukrainian part of the new left, which been active in volunteerism and humanitarian help for the soldiers or for those affected, for the civilians affected in certain areas. Some of the leftists, they joined the Ukrainian army. Also, the attempts to form like a left-wing ideological unit were largely unsuccessful so far. And so, basically like a drop in the ocean of like almost 1 million soldiers mobilized in Ukraine right now. The humanitarian initiatives are also of a small scale. There are also like many people who participate in humanitarian initiatives right now. The more critical to the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian nationalist part of the left, or the new left as well, they are trying to operate in a kind of underground. There is actually a few Marxist-Leninist groups who try to do kind of like propaganda, but also doing this in a formal thinking about their disclosing their identities and so taking a lot of precaution for that. There have been a number of cases of repressions or arrests of the left activists. The Communist Party, basically the leader of the party supported Russia, and he moved to Belarus in the very first weeks of the invasion. And at this moment, it's difficult to say for how many people he actually speaks in Ukraine. Although the number of the people who still identify with the party could be quite large. So in 2014, that party numbered, or at least officially claimed, and they about 100,000 card holding members. That number significantly declined in the next years. The problem is that they basically cannot do any public activity, and most of those Romanian members are likely very old to be capable for any underground activities. Also, it's also quite likely that some of them help Russians. There have been some criminal cases, so like the communists were actually, in certain ways, help the Russian army. And then on the occupied areas, many communists supported Russia, and they greeted them and took an opportunity when, for example, certain settlements, which the Russians returned the monuments to Lenin, which were dismantled in most parts of Ukraine in the decommunization campaigns. That's an explanation about. Why it's not so much to talk about that right now?
Right, I understand. I guess I have a very left oriented view, and I'm kind of trying to find or understand how the left is shaping up in other parts of the world, as even as you know, obviously in Ukraine, the left has been, as you described at length, completely shut down and also made relevant. But I am just curious about you, you know, as someone who's described as coming out of the new left. So that's why I was asking. So I have one last question about that and we can move on completely. But which is that in the early 2000s, which is, I think, around when this new left movement that you were part of was around in Ukraine, would you describe that as rather than being a party, maybe a little bit more of a subcultural milieu around universities? Would that be an accurate way to think of it? Because I grew up in the, you know, I was in my 20s in the 90s, and the left I knew was really a subcultural left where you go to info shops, maybe you'd be going to a protest. There might be some magazines that you would read, but there was no electoral effort being made by the actual left that I knew about. And there was not, there was even a, there were a lot of debates about whether or not we were becoming a lifestyle rather than anything political, that the left was being transformed into a lifestyle. I don't know if that would apply at all in Ukraine, but is it accurate to say that what you had to work with was a kind of a subcultural movement amongst educated students at that time?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. But at the same time, the United States context is obviously different. It's also very different also from the European context. Yeah. So even in 2000s, before the Euromaidan revolution, the communist and socialist parties were declining in their support. That support has been declining, but at the same time, they did have parliamentary factions. Mm-hmm. So the communists had the Communist Party polled 13% in 2012. So at the moment when the post-Euromaidan government banned the party, it was actually a relevant opposition party with significant support. Also, well, you could criticize them for their politics. It's just to understand the scale, the capacity for impact. And that's obviously different from the United States political system.
Right.
Like for many reasons. Right.
Right. Right.
The milieu within which I was active, it was pretty small, and there were subcultures, but not even necessarily connected to the universities, but more like to the informal lifestyle, music, punk, anti-fascist, that kind of subcultures, which at a certain moment they were starting to be politicized. They were specifically also politicized about the threat of the extreme right and violent attacks over neo-Nazis and radical nationalists. That student union, which I was describing before, it also had some clashes with the Nazis, more often it was the Nazis who were attacking them. So there was also like what you described as kind of like university milieu, but just to understand the scale, not even close in comparison to the scale to the left-wing milieu in the American universities or in European universities, where actually the mainstream in the academia is at least left-liberal. Not speaking about like communists or anarchists, but also there are actually quite a lot of Marxists in academia, or at least sympathetic to Marxism, but kind of like covering this as it's not exactly beneficial for an academic career. But we are not being openly in a conversation with Marxism and so on, but at least left liberal, right? But the mainstream, modes in the Ukrainian universities were far from that. rather kind of like by default anti-communist. Not necessarily strongly ideological anti-communist, but still, that was actually a class issue. The positions of the Soviet intelligentsia that for a certain period of time started to be quite critical, skeptical, and openly hostile against the Soviet state. And also the developments specific in some specific places, for example, where I was a student and then a lecturer in Kyiv Mohyla Academy, which was like established as a nationalist university from the start. And it did have some impact on the internal moods in the university. But at the same time, my university, which again, not exactly representative for the whole education system in Ukraine, it was more like a small elite university. Because it was more like nationalist, or at least with some articulated political agenda, it was also more politicized, and there were more like political students there, more politically, more politicized lecturers. So there was some political milieu. Within that milieu, there was a new left wing, and we were capable to have some events and have some even certain space within the university where we could like communicate with the students and invite the external audience there. They were doing some journals, magazines, so I was active in the common journal Social Criticism magazine for quite a long time until I left. And so, but then the impact of that media was objectively much smaller in scale than
right.
Then you had in the United States, even in the 1990s or in 2000, well before the left-wing politicization of the financial crisis, I suppose, 2008. Mm-hmm.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the Maidan Revolution, and I had written down in advance a question that you can question my question. Maybe I'm asking this the wrong way. But would it be fair to say that as unique as Ukrainian history is, that what caused dissatisfaction in Ukraine around 2014 was similar to the causes behind the Yellow Vest movement in France that came later? And the other way to ask this question is, to what extent is the current war in Ukraine a consequence of the global economic crisis of 2008? These are, I don't know if you can see the train of thought behind the question, but to what extent would you contextualize the uprisings in Ukraine as reactions to the economic crisis of 2008, the struggles of Ukraine that were particular to Ukraine in that context, as opposed to perhaps an organized political project of a left of some kind, or even of a right of some kind?
Yeah. Well, that's a huge question. Well, I'll try to respond to the most important parts of that. So, as I said, I do think that the seeing Ukrainian politics in the global perspective is very important. It's also important because Ukraine are largely post-Soviet space, might serve also as a kind of like a magnifying glass to many global processes. The economic crisis was important, and also it was important specifically, the scale of the impact of the economic crisis itself on the Ukrainian economy was quite large in comparison to Europe. So with the exception of Latvia, if I'm not mistaken, only Ukraine had the biggest drop in 2009, if you measure it in GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was more like stagnation, right? And Ukrainian economy was fragile even before that. And so you understand that it was a stagnation stagnation of crisis. Well, but this kind of economic crisis, I don't think they impact the politics in a very direct way. It's usually mediated.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many other, like more like political, social processes that mediate the impact of the economic crisis. So, well, there is this very classic discussion for like more like criticism of Gramsci, criticism by Gramsci of Rosa Luxemburg, where Luxemburg was actually thinking about like direct impact of the economic crisis on politics. But Gramsci said, no, it's much more complicated. There is like politics intervening there. There is civil society, which preserves the defense, the state during the time of the economic crisis. The problem was that actually the social political connections were also weakened. And they were weakened in post-Soviet countries and in Ukraine to an extraordinary extent. So the discussion about the crisis of democracy, crisis of legitimacy, crisis of political representation, they started, I believe, in the 1970s. In many parts of the world. So, well, Jürgen Habermas was writing about the crisis of legitimacy of late capitalism, I think in the late 1970s, where those writers appear. So there was this concern that the Western democracies are not exactly what kind of like starting to lose their representation of the people's interest, and the traditional parties are starting to be less and less representative of the classes and groups from which they emerged and on which they tried to represent in the earlier times and to when they had massive membership and also massive networks of organizations penetrating the whole of society. So that was a social democratic party model, the communist party model, but also some of the Reichian party, the Christian Democrats were also. Going to that. And then it started to kind of like to disintegrate. The party membership declined, the membership in the civil society associations that declined, the absenteeism during the election started to rise. And so the societies became less political, less mobilized, less organized. And that's some of the processes that actually it resembled a lot the post-Soviet politics, with the exception of that actually the Soviet society was strongly organized. It was organized by the Communist Party apparatus and the apparatus of the various civil society organizations. That apparatus declined. It started to decline well before the Soviet Union collapse. Those processes started in the end of the 1960s, at least, maybe even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then it collapsed. And the outcome was a void, a much bigger void than it emerged in the Western countries. Peter Mayer, one of a very interesting social scientists, has a book, Ruling the Void, How to Do in the Situation of the Crisis of Political Representation and all the morbid symptoms creates. Mm-hmm. So that void in the post-Soviet countries was much bigger because there was a problem from above, from the side of the political representatives, and most of the parties had to be created from the scratch. And this is precisely the reason why these patronage networks were so important. And also there was a problem from below. Even the social, economic, corporate interests were poorly organized. So that gives the whole discussion about the weak civil society in post-Soviet countries. It was not necessarily weak, but it was narrow. Because the number of people who claimed any kind of membership in any kind of civic or political organizations were below 20% in Ukraine for all of the post-Soviet period. And that was some of the lowest numbers in the whole world.
Hmm.
And it doesn't mean that there was no any other civic political activity. Of course, many informal initiatives, the revolutions, which are also like political activity. But the problem was that how to institutionalize it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get the situation when the crisis of political representation is actually felt on a more intense scale. One of the other important reasons is also the nature of the Soviet political class or the ruling class in Ukraine. Well, those notorious oligarchs, or I call them political capitalists after Branko Milanovic or Ivan Seleni, who's a very famous Hungarian sociologist. The fraction of the class which whose major competitive advantage are selective advantage, benefits from the state. Selective privileged access to the state, which is quite typically described as corruption. Mm-hmm. And but for them, it was like the major competitive advantage. Sure. In contrast to, for example, the capitalists who rely on the technological innovation or on the super exploitation of labor force. Mm-hmm. And so these people who appropriated the former state property created during the state socialist regime, they didn't have any kind of legitimacy from the very start. So there was, mm-hmm. there was a primitive accumulation process, but not in the course of centuries, but in the course of months. Mm-hmm. So the people were seeing that those factories that were they were working on, the factories which worked, or at least nominally for the benefit of the whole people, for the whole Soviet people, they were appropriated. Some of them were destroyed immediately. Some of them started to work for the for those oligarchs, and that was happening on our eyes. You've been witnessing this. There was not some story from the 16th or 17th century in Marx Capital, the chapter on the primitive accumulation. That was you've been seeing this. Our parents were seeing this. And there was no religious, no traditional, no ideological justification for that at all. So the crisis of political representation was from the very start of the extraordinary scale. And you get the two kinds of responses. One of them is also retarded response or conservative response, which is actually the leadership like Putin, Lukashenko, the authoritarian leader which enforces the long-term interests of the ruling class and stops the centrifugal disintegration for their opportunistic interests. When it doesn't work, we've had the Maidan revolutions, like in Ukraine, big revolutions in the course of just one generation. These revolutions, they brought the amorphous masses to the politics without any mediation. But they were not capable to organize the popular will in order to change something in the interest of the popular masses. So in this way, this Maidan revolutions, they responded to pretty similar crises that was felt also by the participants of the occupiable street, of Indignados, of the Arab Spring revolutions, of protests in many Latin American countries in the recent decade. But they were also reproducing the very crisis, maybe even intensifying the very crisis in the course of the event. Because it was so easy, to be hijacked by the elite groups who did not represent the interests of the majorities. There is a lot of similar processes that lead to that revolution, but you also need to understand the scale of the crisis, the scale of the, let's say, amorphousness of those responses. So, for example, no attempt to organize any kind of Podemos party on that kind of scale, or Corbyn, movement, or at least like his short-term attempt to lead the Labour Party, or Bernie Sanders' campaign in the United States. So this will also responses to the crisis of political representation. They've been fragile. You've seen that they did not achieve what many people hoped for. But in case of Ukraine, we didn't even have like that. We had massive mobilizations with revolutionary expectations, with revolutionary repertoire of action, which led to being hijacked by the oligarchic elites, by the neoliberal NGOs, by the radical nationalists, but not being even capable to start in kind of like populist, at least any kind of progressive movement or campaign that would kind of like had a long lasting development, even in comparison to those not perfect examples which I mentioned.
You can listen to the rest of this podcast on Patreon. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.